It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A rally in support of raising the minimum wage will be taking place on April 15th around the world. Here in Pittsburgh, an event will be held on the corner of Forbes and Bigelow. While everyone should be fairly compensated for work performed, is a $15 minimum wage realistic? How could it impact employees and our economy? We're posing these questions to contributor Brian O'Rourke, a professor of economics at Robert Morris University. Brian O'Rourke, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be here, Paul.
If the country were to adopt a $15 an hour minimum wage, from jobs to prices, what would be the overall impact on our economy?
Well, that's a kind of a tricky question, but we'll try to answer that one. The effect will probably not be felt immediately. What's going to happen is it's going to take a little bit of time for that wage to trickle down through prices. And inevitably, what will happen is businesses, especially small businesses who are not making big profits, are going to have to pass that cost on to their consumers, or they're going to have to reduce their workforce. There have been studies that have been done to show how just raising the minimum wage even a little bit will definitely show up in food prices, because a lot of people who work at the low end of the wage scale work not just at McDonald's and in food preparation, but they pick the crops, they work in the agricultural industry. So we'll see pretty much everything that we need to buy get more expensive, and a lot of the stuff we just like to buy will get more expensive as well. So while wages will go up, and for some people that'll be a really good thing, I worry about raising it that much so quickly. It's more than doubling the minimum wage, and seeing what the impact will be, not just on people at the low end of the wage scale, but people who are just a little bit above that, and people who are in the middle incomes as well, because the things that they buy are just going to become pricier.
And you said that you are concerned, and rightly so, as someone who is an expert in economics, about almost doubling the minimum wage from what it is now. But hasn't the minimum wage grown so slowly and in such small increments that doubling it really ought not matter?
Well, it has grown slowly, and that's a really good point. As far as keeping up with inflation, it hasn't. But making this really big change in the minimum wage affects businesses in a way.
You're saying businesses have gotten used to it.
Well, yeah, businesses have gotten they plan based on this particular wage. They plan their prices, what they can afford to charge people, consumers, and that kind of stuff. And when you sort of pull the rug out from under them in that sense, that has a big impact. You can't expect businesses to continue to do business in the normal way when some of these businesses, their major cost, their primary cost is labor. And when you increase it that quickly, that poses the problem. So if you increase it up to $15 an hour, but do it over a longer period of time, let people adjust to it, it's much, much easier to handle.
Would a $15 an hour minimum wage, how would that impact a company like McDonald's, which is making huge profits?
Well, that's a really interesting question. We have to think about who receives those profits. A lot of it goes to shareholders, but the CEO makes it. Let's not kid ourselves here. The CEO makes a lot of money. The CEO, his salary is in the neighborhood of about $1.5 million, just his base salary, and then he gets an additional about $7 million on top of that with stock options and other perks of the job. But one of the things that people, they hear that number and they think, wow, he makes so much more than the hourly worker, and that's absolutely true. But if you break it down as to how much each store would contribute to the CEO, and McDonald's has over 35,000 stores, even if the CEO made nothing and that money was all distributed to the workers, each worker is only going to see their income go up about $10 to $20 a year. We're talking about spreading that entire salary over all of the workers that McDonald's have. It's going to have virtually no impact on those individuals. To raise the income of all of the people who work at McDonald's would require McDonald's to either pay their upper management next to nothing, or to, instead of distributing profits to the shareholders, distribute it to the workers. And maybe that's what people would like to see, but that makes it really difficult for McDonald's to raise capital to expand their operations. McDonald's spends a lot of money on advertising for all of their franchisees. And while the CEO might make a lot of money, the franchisees, the individuals who run the local stores, they're not making the money that the CEO is making. So
what impact would cutting the salaries of say, McDonald's CEOs have on the income of workers?
It would have virtually no impact at all on the individual workers, other than the CEO. It'll have a big impact on them, but the individual workers would see virtually no change in their income.
What other challenges come with raising the minimum wage?
Well, there's always the question about who's going to keep their job. There's the question of, will people get laid off? And most studies show that there isn't a mass layoff when the minimum wage, and we've had enough minimum wage increases to study this, there's not an immediate mass layoff of people when the minimum wage. This is sort of a straw man that's set up. But what does happen is that as businesses adjust the way they do business, and they now have a higher cost input, they try to reallocate the way they do business. Some businesses simply can't. If it's a service industry, you can only get rid of so many employees, or you can only not hire so many employees, because at some point the service is going to be terrible and no one's going to patronize the business. But over time, what will happen is businesses will try to reallocate their input mix so that the resources are going to inputs that are less costly and more productive. And I think the issue of productivity is a really, really important one. As people argue for higher wages, they have to justify why they get a higher wage. If they're more productive, then they earn the higher wage. People will oftentimes refer back to Henry Ford and how, you know, the Ford Motor Company, they paid people a higher wage, and wasn't that great? They paid people a higher wage so they could afford cars. Well, Ford definitely wanted people to buy his product, so he helped raise their wages. But he also understood that if he paid people more, they could be more productive. And that was really good for the bottom line. So while he sort of took a hit on the front end, paying workers more, he also got more out of them. And so one of the questions that has to be asked about minimum wage workers is, how productive can they be in the jobs that they have? If they can be more productive, then they should be paid more. Absolutely. And businesses would be foolish not to pay them more, because the more productive a worker is, the more valuable they are to your competition.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Brian O'Rourke, a professor of economics at Robert Morris University, about the minimum wage and the idea of raising the minimum wage, perhaps to as much as $15 an hour. Brian, who makes the minimum wage?
Mostly, people who make the minimum wage are young. A vast majority of people making the minimum wage are under the age of 25, typically between 16 and 25. They are almost, well, about 81% of them have no children. They tend to be a little bit disproportionately female making the minimum wage. Here in Pennsylvania, we only have about 190,000 people who make the minimum wage in the entire state. And again, about 60% of those have a high school diploma or less in terms of education, and nearly the same percentages are under 25 years of age. So we're talking about people who fill the low-skilled jobs in the state and in the country. Those are the people who we're talking about.
Walmart is the nation's largest private employer. Last month, they announced an hourly pay increase. Other retailers have followed suit. Why is Walmart in favor of this wage increase?
That's such a great question, because you would think a company like Walmart pays a lot of people minimum wage, and it's going to cut into their bottom line. But follow the money. For Walmart, they can afford to pay higher wages. They are in a much stronger financial position than a lot of their local competitors, the small businesses who, if they have to start raising wages, it's really going to hurt them. They don't have the ability, as Walmart does, to strike deals with their suppliers. And so Walmart sort of looks at this as a way to help, through the legislative mechanism, to help get rid of some of their competition. They can say what they want about paying people more, but they could have already been paying people more. The fact that they're going along with this, I think, is a signal that, hey, this is, people complain about Walmart trying to drive mom and pop out of business. Well, we don't have to do that if the minimum wage goes up, because the minimum wage has the ability to drive those people out of business for us.
And is that a good thing for the American economy?
No, not really. Anytime you have competition, it's a good thing. And even if those mom and pop stores sell their products at a little bit higher prices, there will be a segment of the population who would prefer to shop with them. If they can't stay in business, that diminishes the ability of companies and individuals to meet the needs that they have and fulfill the wants that they have in their preferred way. Everybody ends up going to Walmart, and then there's certainly a segment of the population who's not real happy about that.
Is there a way to raise wages and not raise the minimum wage?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen throughout the course of American history, we have seen a steady increase for inflation-adjusted wages. I was talking to my wife about this question yesterday, and she asked me whether I thought I could do what she did. She was trained as a physician assistant, and I said, absolutely not. No one in their right mind would want me in an office with them trying to even take their temperature. It would go very badly. I'm just not trained to do that. And she said the same thing. She said, there's no way I could do the job that you do. And I'd really have a problem doing the job that you do. We have skill sets that enable us to work well in the jobs that we work in. And part of that it comes from education. Part of that comes from training. A lot of it comes from the experiences we have. And building those experiences are what really help us to make more money. And jobs like McDonald's, jobs like I worked at, for minimum wage at Toys R Us, jobs like those entry-level jobs, which are the vast majority of minimum wage jobs, are really important to help get people a background in working, get them an employment history, and then you can move up because of the skills that you begin to develop. Education is a very important thing. It helps you to not only figure out what kind of jobs are out there, but to develop some skills and to send a signal to employers that you can stick with something and you're able to figure things out and achieve goals and work with other people and those kinds of things. Sort of carte blanche saying everybody should make more money detracts from the incentives that people have to pursue job opportunities, to pursue education. It basically makes, for a lot of people, it makes the incentive to go to college a lot less. So what do we need to do to raise wages? We need to help increase the productivity of workers. We need to make sure that people who go to college get into majors where they are going to become employable at higher wages. I hate to say this in the education field, there's a lot of majors that just are not valuable to the people who go to college. They end up in debt and they end up working.
Not
minimum
valuable
wage.
because they're not good paying jobs.
Exactly.
And it's not going to help them pay off their loans.
That's
their
exactly.
Debts
and they're not going to find good work. They're not going to find jobs that are going to pay them what they think they're worth.
Brian O'Rourke is a professor of economics at Robert Morris University. He's talking about the push to raise the minimum wage to $15, whether that makes sense for the region and the country. And again, there's a rally in support of raising the minimum wage taking place on April 15th here in Pittsburgh. An event will be held on the corner of Forbes and Bigelow. Brian O'Rourke, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
It's always a good time. Thanks.
And coming up, our look at the minimum wage continues with a preview of tomorrow's rally. This is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Tomorrow, low-wage workers around the country are going on strike. They're coming together to demand the minimum wage be raised to $15 an hour. Here in Pittsburgh, an event will be held on the corner of Forbes and Bigelow. Joining us now in Studio A to preview the rally are Reverend Richard Freeman. He's president of the Pennsylvania Interfaith Impact Network. Reverend Freeman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Paul.
Also with us is fast food worker Ashana Osborne. Ashana, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Should the minimum wage be raised to $15 an hour? Will it help or hurt employers and the economy? If not, what should the minimum wage be, in your opinion? 412-246-2002 to take part in the conversation. Reverend Freeman, what can you tell us about the rally being held here in Pittsburgh tomorrow?
Central to the rally is rooted in our moral thought that everybody should work 40 hours a week, should get be able to sustain their families. And we believe that it is an introductory place to start is $15 an hour. If we just look historically where we've been, if we'd raised the minimum wage just to keep consistent with inflation, we'd have a minimum wage close to $20 an hour right now since 1978. So where is the problem? I think the problem is a moral problem. Ergo, that's why the Pennsylvania Interfaith Impact Network and our congregations are engaged. We have a fight because somewhere we've just reduced America to just an economic argument. When we add in the moral imperative, it demands a shift in our priorities. And right now, we don't have that shift in priorities. I was listening earlier about from an economic worldview. Sure, some people are going to have some pain and endure some pain. But we must also appreciate how many people are enduring pain every day. Moms and dads who cannot support their families. Moms and dads who are working 2 to 3 jobs. And when you think about the economic impact of that, which was a part of my graduate study, we determined on a totally different trajectory, but we're looking at about anywhere from $60,000 to $80,000 to $100,000, depending on the community you're living in, on social service network cost when we don't pay people a living wage. And so, yes, we're advocating for a $15 wage, but a stronger advocacy is for a living wage. And that's not a hard number to equate in Pittsburgh or any other community.
You mentioned you talked about how in such small increments the minimum wage has been raised over the years, and pointed out that it could be raised reasonably to $20 an hour. So how did we arrive? The president is pushing for $10 an hour. Mm-hmm. Give them 10 is the big slogan. Yeah. So how did we arrive at 15? Is that just the halfway point between 10 and 20, or is there some other economic factoring that goes into that?
There was a president that most of us will smile when we even mention his name, Richard Nixon, in the 70s, advocated a minimum income level for all workers in America. And those on the progressive wing said, nope, we won't support it simply because there's not enough money. I wish we had Richard Nixon back. Because a minimum income level for all people would put us at a place where we can then index it to something. Had it simply kept pace with inflation, we wouldn't be where we are right now. I look at the growth of productivity in America since 78. I look at where average incomes have happened since 78. Up prior to 78, they ran pretty much in tandem. Since 78, we've seen a widening of the gap. Productivity continues to go up. And so I disagree with the economist's argument that productivity hasn't changed in America. It absolutely has. But average American worker wages have flatlined. What's the difference between those spaces? It's called wealth. Who's getting it? It's not the average worker. So we've got a moral imperative to change the paradigm so that the man, the woman that works gets to participate by the sweat of their brow in the income that happens.
But is that the best way to do it? If we certainly are seeing a disparity between sure. upper income and lower income Americans. That there's no denying that is there. Mm-hmm. But is raising the minimum wage the way to close that gap? The best way to do it.
Government has always been a partner in the argument. Trained as an economist, Milton Friedman would argue the laissez-faire attitude that just let it be, let the market do what the market does. But I'm kind of more of a Keynesian view that there is a place for government to regulate disparities in our economy and how the economy operates. And I believe if we do that well, had we done it well, starting back to 1978, we wouldn't have these problems. And I would suggest to you, Paul, if we look at historically, this is a relatively new problem in America. We did not have this problem leading up to 1978. We had a very close line between productivity and wages of the worker. 78, something drastic happened. I like to think of it as monopoly got operationalized, and people became greedy. And therein lies the problem. Tell me a CEO who makes $424 an hour. That's about the equivalent of making $1 million a year. Can they survive on that? Some of them right now would tell you, oh, no, I can't survive on that. Well, please tell me how a worker supports themselves on $7 an hour. Another part of the argument is when we start looking at the economic impact, we've got to appreciate the fact that education is being priced out of the market. Since 1978, educational tuition costs in America have gone up, ready for this, tenfold. We've done work on medical care because it's gone up 750%. Okay, but health tuition costs have gone up tenfold. We've got to do something about that. So you're asking people to get an education to be upwardly mobile, but we can't even afford it.
And I want to work. I want to get our fast food worker, Ashana Osborne, in on the conversation. But we also have a caller on the line. And by the way, Reverend, very interesting that you brought up Richard Nixon, who did, in fact, regardless of what your opinion may be about the man and his presidency, he grew up in a relatively poor family in California that relied on assistance, and he was very much an advocate for low-income Americans. Let's go to the phones. We have Eric in Wilkinsburg. Eric, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hi, Eric. Are you there?
Hello. Yes,
there you
I'm
are.
Here.
Hi. Go ahead.
I
You're on the air.
I just wanted to say, first of all, I appreciate the Reverend's perspective on this. I think it's very important to understand that productivity has increased and workers have not been paid for that. That money has been dispersed to the wealthy time and time and time and time and time again through decades. But furthermore, the economist said, well, okay, so if we gave back all the money from the CEO, it's a very simplistic and frankly condescending way to look at it. Because the fact is, when the CEO makes $1.5 million, the guy beneath him doesn't make $100,000. He makes $850,000. And you got six of those guys. And you got six guys beneath him who won't be making $100,000. All that money is moving only to the top. And until they change that and change what the CEO makes, they're not going to lower the wages of these other high-end people. Also, that harms businesses. Because if you're selling to high-end people or selling high-end products or costly products, you only have a few people to buy from you. Therefore, it would do business good if the wealth were spread more to the working people, even to middle management.
Good points, Eric. I appreciate your call, and I want to bring Ashana Osborne into the conversation, someone who is with us here in Studio A. She's on the front lines of this fight. First of all, Ashana, may I ask you what you are currently being paid per hour?
$7.25.
So you're being paid the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a difference would being bumped up to $15 an hour, what would that mean to you? How big of a difference is that for your family?
A whole lot. I honestly don't like depending on welfare assistance, and that's what they're subsidizing me to do. Being that I only make $7.25, it's like they're making me settle for less, making me, you know, force myself to live in the projects, force myself to live on the welfare assistance, food stamps, cash assistance, whenever. If I make more than $7.25, if it's 10 or 15, I'll be able to do for me and my son better than having to wait for that check every two weeks a month, $158, and that's way more than what I can only make off of working myself. $7.25 is just chump change. That's just, I have to decide which bill is more in importance that week and let the other one slip into my next paycheck. I shouldn't have to configure which priority when all my priorities are a priority. Which one is higher in importance off that one paycheck and have to let the other linger into the next one? And that's my risk. That's either, okay, do I pay rent off this paycheck or do I go food shopping? Do I get my baby clothes or do I pay my light bill? And it shouldn't be like that. I should be able to be comfortable, me and my coworkers or the people that are bringing in the business for these companies. If it wasn't for us, there wouldn't be none of these businesses. And that's what I strongly believe in. They're not going to get off their high horse and come flip these burgers or take these orders like how we are. And we're the ones bringing in the profit. If I'm running a business hour and we're making at least $30,000 that hour, you know, when we're getting crushed in lunch, I'm not seeing any of that profit. And I'm the one that just made it for you. It's just not right. $15 an hour in a union is more protection for us, consistent schedules, consistent hours, and a better wage.
Can I ask you who you work for? And if you don't want to say, if you're uncomfortable.
No, it's fine. I work for Arby's.
You work for Arby's.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so have you ever gone to your employer or your boss and said, and explained this predicament to them and said, how do I go about, assuming you've been there for a while, have you ever gone to them and said, how do I go about getting more money? This is what I need. And so how does that conversation go?
It's always get a better education, get a better job, or work your way up to management. And I feel like if they say that it's supposed to be a starting job, these jobs are not supposed to be a career, you telling me work my way up to management, you're making it out to be a career. This can be a career. There's people who worked at McDonald's, Arby's, Burger King for 30 years and still or struggling, if I could get a better education, that's putting myself more into debt. I know a lot of students and teachers who took that advice, okay, get a better education and get a better job. You're just going to school to get much more into debt. You're not going to get that job in that field of degree that you was going to school for right away. And that puts you in that position where you have to get something on the sidelines to pay off your bills or what have you until you do get into that field of the industry that you was going to school for. And nowadays, that's not nowhere to be found.
And you have a child, so there's yes. Child care considerations uh-huh. there as well. While everyone should be fairly compensated for work performed, we've established that during the course of this program. Is a $15 an hour minimum wage realistic? And Reverend Freeman, you spelled out earlier, why that figure, how that figure was arrived at. Why the push is for 15 an hour. Is there something less than that? Is there a compromise figure that would work, say, for someone like you, Ashana? Or have we pinpointed 15 and are we saying it's got to be 15?
It has to be 15, and it is realistic. About 29 states throughout the nation have bypassed their $15 an hour in a union, so it can happen. They can afford it.
How productive can a worker be in their job? We heard this argument put up in our previous conversation with the economist Brian O'Rourke. And the question for the employer, for the economist looking at this issue becomes, even though, again, the minimum wage has been raised in such small increments and is only $7.25 an hour, you would still be doubling that minimum wage. So the question then becomes, how much more can you get out of the worker? Can you get something close to twice as much production out of the worker if you raise the minimum wage to 15? And I'm looking at this from the employer's point of view.
You got to start thinking of a broad macro concept. The reality is, how do we make money in America? We are a consumption-based economy. All right? So if we are concentrating wealth in the hands of a narrow few, which is exactly what is happening, those monies are not being spent. All right? I can go buy – I wish I could. If I bought $1 million plane, it will help a very narrow few people. But if I that kind of wealth is redistributed to people who are in the middle income, lower income echelons of our culture, they're going to buy toilet paper. They're going to buy even McDonald's. They're going to buy cereal. All of those things have the multiplicative effect of stimulating our economy. Those are realities. That's economic theory that has been verified historically. And I'm sorry, I refuse to accept the notion that it always has to be a meritocracy notion. All right? You're talking to a guy who grew up on welfare. You're talking to a guy where America once had an ideal that it did help people up the ladder. Okay? And so I know that experience. I've lived with holes in my shoes. I've lived in poor, dilapidated homes. But by the grace of God and systems by the government that allowed me to get an education, that allowed me to ascend, I'm at a better place in my life. And I refuse to believe that America doesn't exist anymore. I refuse to believe that we can't make a moral argument that all my brothers and sisters should be treated equal. In my spiritual tradition, there's a story called about the Good Samaritan, and we've capitalized that in our work at Penn, and we call it Love Thy Neighbor campaign. We are calling on a $15 hour wage rate. Why? Simply because we love our neighbor. And if we have the heart to believe it, we can do it. But if we get saturated on greed, it won't happen.
Let's take another call from Corey in Pittsburgh, who has a question that kind of goes along with a question I was going to ask, which is what the employers say is that if we have to raise the employee wages to $15 an hour as a minimum wage, that would put us out of business. Maybe not McDonald's or even Arby's, but other companies say that would be a problem. Corey, go ahead with your question.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to this show for a long time. And what makes me think if the minimum wage is raised, jobs will just disappear. When you go to a McDonald's in Paris, there's no employees who take your order. You deal with a kiosk. When you go to check in at the airport, you no longer deal with employees. You deal with kiosks. And my thought is, if anything in this conversation will be raised, the fact that jobs will just disappear for the minimum wage employees.
It's an interesting point. What about the idea that I haven't been to a McDonald's in Paris, so I didn't know that you went to a kiosk to order your Big Mac. Yeah. What about that? I mean, that potentially could be a problem for someone like Ms. Osborne. It would eliminate her job possibly.
Here's the reality. If we, as a nation, literally could put men and women on the moon, all right, we can make a decision to work through the hard problems. Our challenge right now is we've become quite too simplistic. We've gotten to a place where we won't encounter the tough challenges. The Panama Canal was built by American workforces. Why? We made the decision to have it done. There was economic reason behind it, and it put a lot of people to work, and it worked, okay? FDR put a lot of people to work, all right? And if I talk to my colleagues, understand, when Shauna was talking about her reality of being on public assistance, we are already paying for it. Let's not make any bones about it. It's called food stamps. It's called the entitlement programs that everybody wants to badmouth right now. But if you want to get rid of the entitlements, tell corporations to act responsibly, okay?
We have come to time. I wish we had more, but it's been a very mm-hmm. interesting conversation, and I want to thank both of our guests, Reverend Richard Friedman, president of the Pennsylvania Interfaith Impact Network, and also our worker, Ashauna Osborne, joining us, sharing her story with us. Thank you, Ashauna.
Thank you.
And again tomorrow, the rally in Pittsburgh at Forbes and Bigelow as workers around the country push for a minimum wage of $15 an hour. Again, thank you both for being here. Coming up, we'll mark the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination by looking at how the news reached Pittsburgh and how the city reacted. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. April 14th, 1865 remains one of the darkest days in American history. It was on this day, 150 years ago, that President Abraham Lincoln was shot while sitting in a box at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. Lincoln died the next day from the wounds inflicted by the man identified as his assassin, John Wilkes Booth. Lincoln's death has been referred to by some writers and historians as the last casualty of the Civil War, which had unofficially ended just days earlier. Here to talk to us about how media outlets of the day covered the event and the reaction to the tragedy here in Pittsburgh is Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Len Barkowski. Len Barkowski, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, thank you very much, Paul. This is a historic day. I'm glad to play a little part in Essential Pittsburgh's commemoration of it.
The gunshot that President Lincoln eventually died from occurred on Good Friday of 1865. So here was all of Catholic America and the heavily Catholic city of Pittsburgh going into Easter weekend when the assassination occurred. It's something that I had not realized until I read your story. Yeah. What about that?
That was seen as almost by many of the ministers in town. And this was a holiday, not only obviously a major feast day, not only for Catholics, but also for Protestants in the city of Pittsburgh. And this was seen as almost a religious event. At Easter, we Christians mark the sacrifice, the death and resurrection of Jesus. There seems something ironic or appropriate, depending on your viewpoint, about the loss of the president on that same day, Good Friday.
If something like that were to have happened today, we would know it the minute it occurred. If we were in Pittsburgh on April 14th, 1865, how long would it have taken for us to get the news from Washington, D.C.?
Most people would have gone to bed on Good Friday, not knowing that the president had been shot. But because of the telegraph, which also during the entire Civil War had managed to bring news from the battlefield back within hours of events, people, when they got up the next morning, there were editions of the Pittsburgh Gazette, there were editions of the Pittsburgh Post that had fairly complete stories on the assassination of the president. That's not to say those reports were perfect, but for a first rough draft of history, they were pretty good the next morning.
And there were plenty of mistakes made, and we'll get into some of that. But who was, assuming that there weren't the wire services like we have today, as they are sometimes called, the Associated Press, for example, being the main one, who was providing that news? Who was at the other end of the telegraph that was going to the Pittsburgh newspaper newsrooms in 1865.
You already had early versions of wire services. The Associated Press, I think, had been created already. It was primarily run by Eastern United States newspapers, and there was some complaint that they didn't provide news as quickly as they should have to newspapers here in Pittsburgh and going further west. We also relied very much on reports here in Pittsburgh. We relied on reports in the Philadelphia newspapers, the New York newspapers as well. Those reports came through fairly quickly. Again, they weren't perfect. You know, for example, they reported that Secretary of State Seward was very likely to die. He had also been attacked the same night that Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater. Secretary Seward was attacked in his home. It was expected that he would die in those initial reports. Fortunately, he did not. He survived his wounds.
And I guess the biggest error the morning of April 17th, 1865, I believe it was, it said in the Pittsburgh Gazette, it was predicted in bold headlines, all caps, "The Secretary will die," end quote.
Correct. The reports on those days also included information on the assassin, who was then described as John Wilkes Booth, B-O-O-T-H-E. His name was spelled in multiple ways in newspapers over the next couple of days.
And also, there were John Wilkes Booth sightings all over the place. And one of the great errors that occurred, and the Gazette reported this, that Booth had been arrested on a train traveling between Altoona and Greensburg.
This was a tough time for young men with dark hair and mustaches and dark mustaches. Booth was a handsome man, but and he would have been very well known. But it's not the sort of fame that Brad Pitts of the world have now. You know, there just weren't that many illustrations. But so a description of a young man of a certain build, of certain coloring, that not surprisingly resulted in a lot of false sightings. The John Wilkes Booth who was arrested on the train between Altoona and Greensburg turned out ultimately to be a hotel keeper from Iowa who had, this was the second time he had been arrested as John Wilkes Booth.
We're talking with Len Barkowski. He is a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter, and he has written about the news cycle and the reaction in Pittsburgh after the assassination of President Lincoln. The shot that eventually killed him fired on April 14th, 1865, 150 years ago today. What were some of the other mistakes that were made in the news coverage?
Well, the biggest one was that this was a nationwide search for Booth and what at one point was thought to be a group of about 30 assassins. This was a confusing time in our country. There had been an attack on the president. There had never been a successful assassination of a U.S. president until that time. Other attacks had been made. Andrew Jackson, for example, was shot in the chest during his time as president. Other presidents had died in office, but this was the first time there had been a successful assassination of a U.S. president. There had also been that attack on the Secretary of State Seward. So there was confusion. There was confusion around the country. John Wilkes Booth was reported to have been seen all over Pennsylvania in the week, 10 days or so that followed. It was something of a relief to the country when it could finally be reported that Booth had been found, had been cornered on a farm in Maryland, and had been fatally wounded and died. Although, of course, just as with the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, the man who I believe shot, and meant most people would believe shot President Kennedy, Booth's killing during attempts to capture him raised immediate questions about possible conspiracies and who else might have been involved. And those questions have lasted for 150 years.
How did Pittsburgh react to the news of the president's death?
Pittsburgh was a strongly Republican community. Abraham Lincoln had been here in 1861 to personally thank Allegheny County voters for their strong 10,000 vote majority in the election of 1860, in November of 1860, the election that saw him become president of the United States, be elected president of the United States. So he was a beloved figure in large portions of the community. It was Easter weekend. On that Sunday, many ministers took their sermons were based on the sacrifice that Lincoln had made then in being at the end of the war, what should have been a time of uh, of subdued triumph, but triumph nonetheless for Lincoln and his government and his belief in union, was turned into a very sad time and a tragic time. That was reflected in the sermons. That was reflected in the canceling of all sorts of public events in the days that followed. There was also a major meeting in downtown where thousands of people got together to honor the slain president. Crape was put up on buildings all over town as well as a sign of mourning. And many people wore mourning badges until the time of the president's funeral in Springfield about two weeks later.
What would a mourning badge look like?
Oh, just in many cases, it would be a small picture of the president with a ribbon either attached below, or many people would have worn the black bands around their suit jackets, just as people did until fairly recently, following a death in the family. In a lot of Pittsburgh homes, that's how the death of the president was perceived, as a death in the family.
And how did the city of Pittsburgh, in addition to wearing the mourning bands, what were some of the other ways that the city marked the president's death?
Well, as I said, the events that were planned were canceled or postponed until a more appropriate time. Buildings would have been draped in black from balconies, from windows. More signs that it was the community, the entire nation was in mourning. Those memories of Lincoln's visit in 1861 would still have been very strong in the minds of many people. And Allegheny County again went for Lincoln in the election of 1864 as well.
And there was an expectation that the funeral train carrying his body, carrying President Lincoln's body back to Springfield, Illinois, would stop in Pittsburgh. Did that happen?
The original plan was for Lincoln's funeral train to follow in reverse the same route that Lincoln had taken when he came from Springfield to Washington, a journey that took him through Pittsburgh. Secretary of War Stanton, who had had a successful legal career here in Pittsburgh and who was married to a Pittsburgh woman, was the final arbiter of the route for that train. And he did make the decision to eliminate Pittsburgh in return for a stop in Chicago. Lincoln hadn't, surprisingly, stopped in Chicago on his way to Washington, but the train was the train route was rearranged to eliminate Pittsburgh on that return trip. So a lot of people who had made plans for an appropriate tribute, similar to the kind of tributes that were held in Philadelphia, that were held in Harrisburg, that were held in Buffalo, they were in the initial stages of making plans for similar tributes here in Pittsburgh. Sadly, that opportunity was not available because the Lincoln funeral train did not pass through Pittsburgh.
Where would it have stopped?
Oh, probably on the north side. Probably on the north side, which is where Lincoln came through in 1861. There's a plaque over there on the north side still marking the spot where the train station stood in what was then Allegheny City, a separate municipality just across the river. It's on the wall of a post office. I suspect thousands of cars, hundreds of pedestrians pass by there daily and don't realize that that history was made on that spot.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Len Barkowski, remembering the day and the aftermath, the days that followed the assassination of President Lincoln, the shot fired by John Wilkes Booth on April 14th, 1865, 150 years ago today. Len Barkowski, thanks so much for being with us here on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
I enjoy coming by. Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any of today's program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at WESA.FM. Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, Mayor Bill Peduto makes his monthly visit. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.